Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. Special education students are incarcerated at higher rates than their K through 12 peers.
It makes us look at the brutal facts. Where do we drop the ball with these kids?
Recent coal bankruptcies have left many Wyoming workers without health insurance. Legislators are discussing new ways to ensure people are protected with few insurance options available.
These are individuals that, through no fault of their own, are now left in a circumstance they can't afford health care.
A month after a police shooting in Riverton, family of Anderson Antelope are still looking for answers about what happened to him.
How does one end up dead because they're considered a public nuisance by a business?
Join us for those stories from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Maggie Mullen.
And I'm Bob Beck. It's been a month since the police shooting of 58-year-old Anderson Antelope in Riverton. Officials have released few details about what happened. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr reports, the incident has drawn new attention to long-simmering racial tensions in the reservation border town.
Dozens are marching down a busy street in Riverton, wearing red, holding signs, and chanting, "Justice for Andy." Anderson Antelope's nephew, Dean Wallowing Bull, says this march is a way to remind Riverton that the family is still waiting for answers about what happened to him.
We haven't had no word from any of the authorities. You know, they still haven't released the name of the officer involved in the shooting.
What authorities have shared is an allegation that Antelope attacked an officer who had been trying to arrest him with a knife. Antelope's family say he was a chronic alcoholic and was physically disabled and mentally unhealthy as a result. When police approached him, they were likely responding to a call about public drunkenness. Eyewitness accounts suggest that no one was in danger when officers first approached Antelope, that things began to escalate when an officer tried to physically move him from the sidewalk in front of the Walmart. This story is all too familiar to the family of another man who was killed by police, Zachary Bareheels.
How does one end up dead because they're considered a public nuisance by a business?
That's Adrienne Chelopaw, Bareheels' sister. She says that her brother, who was Kiowa and Lakota, was experiencing a mental health crisis when Omaha police detained him outside of a convenience store. He died after officers punched him in the head repeatedly and fired a taser at him 12 times. 3 years after her brother's killing, Chelopaw says the effects are still rippling through his tribal communities. She says it troubles her as her children grow up, looking less like Native boys and more like Native men.
I have a pretty severe case of PTSD right now because of this fear of the police. But at what point does the criminal justice system take responsibility for the breakdown in the trust in communities?
According to data from the Centers for Disease Control, Native people are killed by police at a higher rate than any other racial or ethnic group. Nationwide, people with mental illnesses are also more likely to experience violence of all kinds, including from police officers. But Antelope's family members believe the circumstances that led to his death are unique to Riverton. His niece, Autumn Wallowing Bull, says that her uncle was what some in the city might derogatorily call a park ranger. That's local slang for a homeless Native person who hangs out in the city park. Wallowing Bull wonders if that label might have led others to view her uncle as a nuisance or disposable.
I don't know if this cop just got frustrated with him, finally had enough of him, pulled his gun and just decided to end him when he could have just tased him or maced him.
Growing up on the Wind River Reservation, Wallowing Bull says she had her own bad experiences with Riverton police. Now, when she visits this reservation border town, she says she notices a difference in the way she's treated. Strangers stare at her, she gets followed around stores. She says she moved away because she doesn't want her children to experience that.
When we do come back here, I always have to tell them, hey, you guys gotta watch out. You know, watch out what you're saying, watch out how you look at certain people, keep your eyes to yourself. And they can feel it when we come back here. They can feel that animosity, that something's different.
The Riverton Police Department didn't want to talk to me for this story. They're still waiting for the State Department of Criminal Investigation to release a report. But Riverton Mayor Richard Gard spoke on their behalf.
Our police department is just that. It's a police department. And when laws are broken, they come and take care of those broken laws.
In other words, according to Gard, they're not there to provide mental health or addiction counseling.
I have total confidence in all of the officers. So I don't think there's a racial slant to this. I think there's people that would like to try to make it a racial slant, but I don't see that. And all the choices that were made by Mr. Antelope.
Mayor Gard says he knows that even though he doesn't believe Riverton police carry any racial bias, some of his constituents feel differently, and that has real consequences. I told him some Native people in Riverton don't ever call the police because they're afraid of what might happen to them or someone they love.
We want everybody to feel safe. We want them to call our police department. And so if I said, no, I don't care about what people's feelings are and their safety level, that would be totally incorrect. I do. The police do. So if you feel like you're targeted or there's a problem, you really should come in and explain to us why you do, and maybe you have a case.
While they wait to learn more about Anderson Antelope's last moments, his family members say they hope people will start to take racial divisions in Riverton seriously and work to break them down. Antelope's nephew, Dean Wallowing Bull, says that starts with the people who are labeled park rangers.
This needs to be addressed, you know, our street people up here in town. They're not safe, you know, and if anybody's on the streets and things happen to them, you know, who do they report that to? Because the city of Riverton police are not going to listen to them.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Savannah Marr on the Wind River Reservation.
Savannah Marr is a Report for America Corps member.
The recent Black Jewel bankruptcy left hundreds of furloughed miners without health insurance. With coal production expected to continue in its decline, state legislators are discussing how to keep that from happening in the future. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports.
Darlene Ray worked in Black Jewel's warehouse before the company filed for bankruptcy on July 1st. I spoke with her earlier this summer when she was struggling to find a job. Months later, she still never found one.
Putting in app after application after application and hearing nothing and getting denied and rejected.
Then, suddenly, unemployment got even harder. Black Jewel canceled her health insurance. She was left with no job and no way to get her insurance back.
And you just hope that nothing serious goes on. You don't have to go see a doctor or go to the emergency room, or that you stay healthy. And that's what I did for 4 months.
Luckily, Ray's back to work now. She got her old job back. But without that, she says there were no alternatives, affordable ones anyway, to get back health insurance.
No, there was nothing else.
Ray isn't alone. About half of Black Jewel's laid-off workers were still without a job when health insurance was axed. And for many, there were few places to turn. Black Jewel is hardly the first time energy workers have lost health insurance from a bankruptcy. Earlier this year, retired miners lost it from the Westmoreland bankruptcy. According to one expert, benefits are often one of the first things to go in a filing. With six coal companies operating in Wyoming filing for reorganization in 4 years, the state legislature decided to form a committee to discuss solutions to reoccurring bankruptcy issues. Laramie Senator and committee member Chris Rothfuss agrees that benefits and health care are important issues to discuss.
These are individuals that, through no fault of their own, are now left in a circumstance where they don't have income. They can't afford health care. And if they end up with some significant sickness or some acute illness in their family, they're not going to be able to afford to go to the hospital, afford to go see a doctor.
The solution for Rothfuss, Medicaid expansion. He sponsored four bills to expand Medicaid since 2014. Normally, Medicaid is a joint federal-state program that provides health insurance for low-income families with children, the elderly, and the disabled. Expansion would add a new category, adults without children considered very low income. A report last year estimated the expansion would provide healthcare access to about 27,000 more Wyomingites, including many who would have no other options. Rothfuss says that could include recently out-of-work coal employees like Ray.
If we're taking seriously the struggles that we'll see in the future, both with coal mine shutdowns as well as power plant shutdowns in other communities around the state, then we have to seriously discuss Medicaid expansion or some other alternative.
Wyoming's Joint Revenue Committee is currently discussing Medicaid expansion. Rothfuss hopes the recent spate of bankruptcies will change some legislators' minds who represent coal country.
Now in districts that are the most vulnerable and with constituents that are most needful of those healthcare benefits.
But for now, minds have not changed, even in coal country. Gillette Senator Jeff Wasserberger says Medicaid expansion would be impossible in a budget session that requires two-thirds vote for introduction. Afton Senator Dan Dockstader said he's not sure how expansion would help anyone right now. And Gillette Representative Scott Clem calls the move premature and questioned whether able-bodied people should be getting Medicaid anyway. And there's even some dispute on whether expansion would work to address displaced energy workers. Wyoming's Department of Health said it would likely help, while the State Department of Insurance's Denise Burke has another idea.
I think it's unlikely that most of the people who worked for either Black Jewel or Halliburton would have qualified for Medicaid, whether it was expanded or not.
Halliburton is an oil and gas service provider that recently laid off workers in Wyoming. Meanwhile, the Select Coal Bankruptcy Committee is looking at other solutions to the health insurance question. Representative Clem says one idea seems to be getting traction.
And one of the things that we had talked about is requiring bonding for companies, particularly, to bond for something like health insurance.
The concept is for companies to set aside money to ensure workers are protected in the case of bankruptcy. Denise Burke said bonding is not a bad idea if done correctly. No matter the mechanism they choose, she says it's urgent to provide help quickly.
The number one reason that families declare bankruptcy is because of a health crisis. So going without health insurance is incredibly frightening.
For now, Burke says the Affordable Care Act marketplace is a possibility for some. She also encourages people to set up a health savings account. Burke says this is a tough issue to solve because the cost of health care is increasing so rapidly. With that in mind, she says it's good to hear that the legislature is taking another look at how to make it more manageable for the average person who can't afford a medical procedure out of pocket.
And I think the legislature is realizing that, and the nature of health coverage has changed. And so I think that's why they are looking at options like the bonding or looking at perhaps changing some things in the bankruptcy.
Former Black Jewel employees are back to work after Eagle Specialty Materials restarted operations, though many are still looking for a long-term solution. Gillette Representative Eric Barlow says he expects bonding for health insurance to come up at the upcoming legislative session. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
When we come back, some regional states are developing a solution for daycare shortages. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Maggie Mullen.
And I'm Bob Beck. According to the Center for American Progress, 34% of people in Wyoming live in childcare deserts. That's when there are a lot more kids than there are openings in licensed childcare centers. Statistics show that it's actually worse in other Mountain West states. Now a number of startups are entering our region that think they can help. Ray Ellen Bichel reports.
A few months ago, Trisha Shields was having a regular day at work.
I think I was daydreaming at my desk.
She was tired of only seeing her kids at bedtime, and she says her job was really getting to her. She was working at a treatment center for people with kidney failure, and she says she'd get close to patients, and then, pretty often, they'd die.
I just needed a change. I wanted a bright start to something new.
She was playing music on her phone when an ad came on.
Do you want to be your own boss? Do you love being around kids?
And I just heard it, and it was like, are you wanting to start your own business? Do you want to be with your kids? Do you want to be around kids? And I'm like, yes, I do.
Just tap the banner.
I said, click here. And I just was like, you know, I never do that. I never click on ads, but I did.
The ad was from a company called My Village. It's one of at least three startups, including WeCare and Wonder School, that are trying to get more people to start childcare centers. And right now, they're making their way into the Mountain West.
We wanted to build a solution for the average American. And so we knew we needed to start in the middle of the U.S., not the coast.
That's Beth Szymanski, co-founder and CFO of My Village, which currently has locations across Colorado and Montana.
Our mantra is that we make it easy to start, run, and grow a home-based childcare program.
Szymanski says there are a lot of things beyond taking care of kids that caregivers have to deal with, like licensing, marketing, a website, taxes, plus all the paperwork for getting subsidies for basic things like the kids' food. The idea is that the startup deals with all that stuff. In exchange, the startup gets 10% of the eventual profit.
And so we want to make it a no-brainer solution for them so that they don't have to worry about the paperwork. They can just focus on the care with the children.
Could companies like My Village help close the childcare gap in our region? Louise Stoney is optimistic.
When I saw what they were doing, it was like, wow, yes, this is what my brain believed was possible. But I had no clue how to make it happen. These young people do.
Stoney is a consultant in early childhood education policy and finance. All that stuff I listed before, paperwork for food subsidies, taxes, marketing. She says those bits and pieces are a big reason there's a high rate of burnout among childcare professionals. They're swamped.
And particularly for home-based providers, they're trying to run a small business out of their home, and they're spending their days and a lot of their energy focusing on caring for children. But then they have to spend their nights and their weekends trying to run a business.
She agrees with the startups that small in-home childcare centers are the answer. And that means we need to make them easier and less lonely to run. Stoney says what they're doing has a name. It's called shared services.
The idea of shared services has been around in other industries forever. I mean, think about it. We've got this tool called Airbnb that allows lots of people to run small businesses out of their homes.
But she says it's a relatively new idea in this industry, which really needs to figure out a way to support all these small business owners.
How do we help them to succeed? How do we link them together? How do we redefine in some way what it means to be a childcare center?
Maybe that new definition will include a lot more places like this basement.
This is the preschool space.
Remember Trisha Shields, the one who is daydreaming at her desk? She renovated her basement in Parker, Colorado.
So over here we have kind of the learning, crafts, puzzles, coloring, things of that nature.
There's a reading corner, a box of costumes.
Animals, music, dinosaurs, puppets, cars.
Even a teeny tiny urinal in the bathroom. Shields just got her license to work with toddlers, and now she's ready to open her doors.
As one of my patients put it before I left, he's like, so you're an entrepreneur? And I was like, well, I guess that's a really big word. Like, he's like, no, but you are. You're starting your own business. You're an entrepreneur. How does that feel? And it kind of hit me. I was like, that feels good.
Those startups are betting that a lot more people will want to share in that feeling. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Ray Ellen Bichelle.
This weekend marks the opening of an exhibit at the Buffalo Bills Center of the West focusing on women throughout Wyoming. It showcases large-scale portraits and interviews with the women. The photographer Lindsay Linton Buck has traveled around the state to meet and learn their stories. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska sat down with the photographer and the two women co-curators of the exhibit, Karen McWhorter and Rebecca West, and asked what stood out about this collection of portraits.
And what I loved about Lindsay's selection is that these are the women that you wouldn't know about. I'd mention Lynette St. Clair. I've known Lynette for years, and she's an educator. She's from Wind River, and being with the Plains Indian Museum, she's the type of person that I have known, and I've appreciated her work and really admire what she's done with the language programs and her language app. But this is not the woman that most people know because she's very modest. She's typically not in the news, but she's done great work. That was the first name that I picked up on, but there's others like Lori Olson, the pilot, and so many other women that if it weren't for this project, I probably wouldn't know their names. There's many more out there, too, and I think that's what's exciting, too, is this just the tip of the iceberg as far as women who are shaping the state and shaping the changing narrative of Wyoming.
I think for me, the subjects collectively and individually, they represent this greater metaphor of the strength and capacity in our state. You know, I obviously can't showcase everyone, but by highlighting women that you have never heard of from some of these smaller towns, and I illuminate women who have been in the spotlight too: Marilyn Kyre, first female Supreme Court Justice; Afy Ellis, Wyoming State Senator. But it's really important for me to have that balance and show that contrast, and also get into the fields and industries where the subjects, just by nature, you know, ranchers even, that they're not out in the spotlight. They are working on the land from dawn until dusk, and unless you're in their town or in their community or in their circle, you don't know about them, but they're making a great impact.
You all are women in Wyoming who are doing pretty cool things, and creating an exhibit like this and being women in Wyoming, I mean, did that give any more perspective to what this means for you personally?
For me, it is absolutely inspirational. Wyoming has allowed me the opportunity to grow in my career in a way that I don't think I would have been able to in another place. And I think that may be the case for many of these women, too. And so I truly, having gotten to know them through Lindsay's podcasts and photographs, I look up to all of them.
Karen and I are both from different locations, whereas Lindsay was born in Powell, Wyoming. What's appealing to me about this project is the fact that when I moved here, it was about 25 years ago, I feel like I did my growing up here as an adult and as a woman in Wyoming. It was a different lifestyle for me. It was something that meant a lot as far as being able to have freedom outdoors. It can be a confining atmosphere sometimes because we are isolated and we don't have a great diversity of people, of religions, etc. But it gave me a really good perspective on what it was like to be a good, kind human being at a different pace. And that's a big thing for me. And I look at the person that I was 25 years ago, and I'm so different because I've had time in this state. So I can only imagine what it would be like to grow up here, too. It must have been wonderful.
Well, I mean, you don't appreciate it, or at least I didn't. But coming back, and especially building this exhibit from the project to the exhibition point and with this team, I mean, the word that I keep thinking of is it's been such an empowering process. And I do think, you know, that is a lot of why we are drawn to living here, is there is a certain sense of you can create yourself and you have the power to do that.
How are you able to take Lindsay's work of photography and audio and make it interactive in an exhibit?
I think it's something that's needed to happen for a long time. We should have done this a lot sooner. It's pretty exciting that we've put these works up on the wall, and each and every one has a QR code. You can listen to the podcast that Lindsay's put together as part of the creation. But another interactive that's going on is the, I guess we could call it the story phone or the story hotline, where
that's good. I love that.
So there's a couple prompts, and visitors can come in and to tell about a woman that's inspiring to them. And we're recording that, and we're going to be gathering this information for the life of the exhibit. And that is something that makes the exhibit changing and flowing as the months go by, because we don't know what we're going to get. And that changes the meaning of the photographs. It can change the tone of the conversation, and it also changes a lot of the content that we have. And I have to tell you, I've been standing in the space as we've been installing the exhibit. I found myself at times just almost moved to tears because I've read these labels and I've looked at the portraits, but when you keep looking at this over and over again, it's overwhelming how much these women have done. And I'm just hoping that feeling transfers to other people.
Do you think it helps that the portraits are so big?
I mean, it really gives these women the presence that they deserve. And it also just fills the space with color and spirit. I love the choice of having them large scale.
Yeah, I gotta go big. We're in Wyoming, honey.
Yes.
I also do think it speaks to Wyoming and the scale of our state, just that spaciousness and sort of that like awe-inspiring quality that so many of us feel by being rooted here.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up in the program, special education students are incarcerated at higher rates than their K-12 peers, and CODI officials rescue a number of fish. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. Special education students are incarcerated at higher rates than their K-12 peers, according to preliminary data gathered by Wyoming Public Radio. Reporter Tennessee Watson has more.
On a tour of the Juvenile Services Center in Cheyenne, Sergeant Jay Stewart explains that juvenile offenders stay here for an average of 49 days. But whether they're here for a week or a year, kids are required to go to school.
Education for us is huge. Reason being, we see the result of where, if they're not getting their education, they continue down that same path.
The path Stewart is referring to leads to prison. According to the National Center for Education Statistics, adults without high school diplomas are more likely to be incarcerated. So to help kids stick with their studies, the detention center has a Laramie County School District number one teacher on site full time. His name is Nate Munter.
Yeah, we've had good success because it's a smaller classroom, so it's more individualized.
Munter has help from a classroom assistant, and he says the deputies on duty will sit down and work with students too. Munter says the kids really benefit from that level of support, and many of them come with individualized education programs.
Just a guess, I would say it's probably 50%.
Known as an IEP, it's a federally required plan families and schools follow to ensure students with mental, physical, behavioral, and cognitive disabilities can access education. Around 14% of K-12 students in Wyoming have an IEP, according to data from the Wyoming Department of Education. But as Munter noted, around half of his students have one. Sergeant Jay Stewart of the Juvenile Services Center has a theory about what's happening.
Some of that is those kids don't want to go to school. So, and then that's where they wind up being truant, and then they're doing other things while they're not at school, and then come here.
But a school district official is less willing to speculate.
There's just so many factors that go into the numbers that you're talking about, the 50%. It's very difficult to make a correlation to why or what impacts that.
Eric Jackson is the assistant director for instruction for Laramie County School District number one. Without more data, he says he can't say whether special education students are somehow more likely to end up in the juvenile justice system than their non-special ed peers. And statewide data is hard to wrangle. The number of special education students involved in the juvenile justice system is not something the Wyoming Department of Education actively analyzes, according to communications director Michelle Panos. So Wyoming Public Radio reached out to districts directly for numbers from the 2018-19 school year. Based on a response from just over half of Wyoming school districts, about 40% of incarcerated students had an IEP. Juvenile offenders can also end up at the Wyoming Boys School and Girls School, where the percentage of special education students has been on the rise. In 2018, the number of students with IEPs at the Boys School had climbed to 46%. At the Girls School, the percentage has reached roughly 26%. The Park County School District No. 6 Special Education Director says this begs some important questions.
And the first one that comes to my mind is, are we adequately meeting the needs of these students?
Peg Monteith says that population has challenges.
They're at risk because they have a disability to begin with, so their educational program and progress may be a struggle. And that just kind of gets a ball rolling with other at-risk behaviors. It's like a snowball effect, I guess.
She says without adequate support, a special education student might not feel engaged and not want to attend school, and might numb feelings of failure and inadequacy with alcohol or drugs. This could eventually lead them to trouble.
It makes us look at the brutal facts. Where do we drop the ball with these kids? No finger pointing, but let's sit down and do some problem solving.
Monteith says Yes, schools can do more, but it's not an issue they can solve alone. And agencies like the Wyoming Department of Education and law enforcement and child and family services need to work together.
If we are somehow missing the boat with this many kids with disabilities, how do we identify the common denominator, and how do we begin to look at our system and where the cracks are, where the potholes are, what's going on that is preventing us from doing a better job?
Monteith says those questions would be easier to answer with statewide data. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
Tennessee Watson is currently enjoying her Nieman Fellowship at Harvard, but she'll be back in 2020 to follow this story and other juvenile justice issues.
The Trump administration is getting sued by 17 states for its controversial plan to overhaul the Endangered Species Act. Oh, this just in, Wyoming is not one of those states. And as correspondent Matt Laszlo reports from Washington, the state's congressional delegation likes the direction the administration is going.
Since former President Richard Nixon signed the Endangered Species Act into law in 1973, it's been used as a shield to protect more than 200 different species, including breathing new life into the gray wolf and bald eagles. But the Trump administration and many in the GOP argue it's now being abused by environmentalists. They accuse them of using it as an economy-stifling bludgeon in the nation's courts. Wyoming Senator John Barrasso chairs the Environment Committee.
To me, the Endangered Species Act has in some ways been hijacked, and it's not been to the benefit of the species. I mean, you want to get species recovered, and when you see the total number of species that go on the list and so few ever recovering to get off, it says we need to do this a different way.
The Trump administration now wants the federal government to consider the economic cost of listing or keeping a species categorized as endangered, which would be a boon to the oil, gas, mineral, and timber industries. Barrasso is supportive and says the act needs updating.
The goal of the Endangered Species Act originally was to, if you put a species on the list, it was so that you could then have a plan to recover it and then get it off the list. But, you know, we've dealt with a situation where for every 100 species listed, only 3 have ever recovered enough to get off for every 100 put on. Well, that's a pretty poor percentage, so we're trying to modernize it.
When former Wyoming Republican Governor Matt Mead chaired the Western Governors Association, the group unveiled a bipartisan proposal to overhaul the Endangered Species Act. Barrasso's now pushing a similar proposal in the Senate, which would give state leaders more say in the recovery and eventually delisting process.
So we want to try to do what works, you know, we believe works in the Rocky Mountain West and take that nationally.
But some Western governors oppose the administration's proposed changes, including leaders in Colorado, New Mexico, and Nevada, who have all signed on to the lawsuit challenging the administration's plan. Arizona Democrat Raul Grijalva, the chair of the House Natural Resources Committee, says money shouldn't be a factor when considering the survival of an entire species.
Including economic benefits as part of the thing, they're setting up that classic, it's the jobs versus the animals. And it's a losing proposition when we lost 3 billion bird species and we continue to lose more. Short-sighted. And business as usual for the industry.
House Democrats have introduced their own legislation to rescind the Interior Department's move, which Grijalva says is the polar opposite from what the White House has been doing when it comes to unwinding a slew of environmental rules and regulations.
The bills we're doing, the bills that are coming, are all dealing with adaptation and mitigation around climate change. That's what we're doing.
Yeah.
And the changes in regulations, the rollbacks, all 86 that Interior and EPA have done, are doing, all they're doing is creating this climate crisis and making it even bigger.
Grijalva says House Democrats are painting a stark contrast to the GOP when it comes to environmental policy.
No, but we are providing a choice for people, and I think come 2020, that choice will be pretty clear.
Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney says bring it on. She's a part of the GOP leadership team in the House, and she serves on Grijalva's committee.
It's the same kind of just political attack that we see too much of.
Cheney argues Democrats are being disingenuous when they accuse the GOP of putting profit for their donors over the environment.
We all want to protect endangered species, but we ought not be in a situation where, human activity and use of our lands and commercial activity is influenced the way it has been, frankly, by radical environmental groups.
The lawsuit seeking to overturn the administration's changes to the Endangered Species Act is now winding through the federal court system, which has Democrats and environmentalists nervous, especially if it makes its way all the way up to the Supreme Court that's now filled with two conservatives handpicked by President Trump. From Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Throughout the West, water delivery systems have been developed for a number of purposes, including agriculture, but sometimes those solutions can lead to problems for fish. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska follows a Trout Unlimited chapter dedicated to saving fish from getting stuck and dying in irrigation canals.
Big fish.
I'm walking behind three others in an irrigation canal down the North Fork outside of Cody. In case you've never seen one, an irrigation canal is a big ditch that redirects water like a creek. One man has a big boxy backpack on that is an electric shocker. The other two have big nets.
Look at that fish.
They are shocking fish in the canal, netting them and eventually releasing them back into the North Fork Shoshone River.
If we didn't get in here today, probably in another day or two, this ditch would be dry.
That's Dave Sweet. He's been a member of the East Yellowstone chapter of Trout Unlimited for over 20 years. Every year, the irrigation headwaters that lets waters into these canals is shut down for the winter. When that happens, up to tens of thousands of fish are trapped into ditches and will die if not rescued.
Rescuing fish out of the irrigation diversions, that's a Band-Aid. You know, we're just taking them back out of those ditches once they're trapped. The ultimate answer is to try and prevent them from being trapped. And so you need fish-friendly screens.
Fish screens are basically what you're imagining. They are structures placed in irrigation canals that lets water go through, but not debris or fish. They do a decent job, says Ryan Elliott. He's a civil engineer that designs fish screens. Elliott says every screen has to be custom made in order to work for the specific conditions they are placed in.
Screens are inherently going to have maintenance, especially during higher debris loading periods in the spring and then occasionally in the fall when you've got leaf litter and stuff coming down.
And it turns out that the fish screen in the North Fork Valley ditch malfunctioned because the solar-powered panel didn't supply enough energy for the screen to operate correctly over a 24-hour period.
Debris got washed down the ditch, jammed against the screen because it wasn't moving, and as a result, when it started up, it actually tore loose the motor mounts on the motor that was turning it.
The screen was difficult to replace because it cost around $25,000. The new plan is to use AC power next year. And they think that will finally address the problem. But until then, they need to get the fish out of the canal and back into the river. The collected fish are being dumped into a tank behind a truck.
Rainbow or the hybrid?
You know,
It's got a lot of spots in the head. It's pretty much a rainbow, I think.
Rainbow trout in a hybrid between rainbows and cutthroats, known as cutbows, mainly populate these waters. Fisheries biologist Jason Burkhart with Game and Fish says these trout are of the greatest conservation need because they are migratory fish. They need to travel to different areas to spawn. He says it's similar to big game migration corridors.
Needing to access different portions of water bodies for different stages of life, whether it's a trout trying to find make it back to its spawning areas, or running downstream into deeper water. You know, there's a lot of fragmentation that has occurred.
In 2010, Governor Matt Mead introduced a program partly aimed at reducing the number of fish that are lost to irrigation canals. Because of the cost of fish screens, the department has been installing fish screens only in the highest priority waters. By the end of the day, the crew heads to a public access area of the North Fork Shoshone River. A truck backs up the tank filled with fish to the edge of the water.
So all we're going to do is open a pipe, and they're going to go flying out here.
Ready?
In one day, the crew of volunteers saved 717 fish. And the chapter hopes there won't be any fish to save next year, since the fish screen should work once more. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
In a minute, we will take you for a ride in a garbage truck as part of a plan Sheridan has to reduce its waste. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Maggie Mullen.
And I'm Bob Beck. Over the years, the Environmental Protection Agency has made new regulations for how to build and manage landfills. In Wyoming, it's led to changes to how landfills are used, discussions about how long they will last, and the consideration of how much building new ones will cost. In Sheridan, the city is testing a program that hopes to extend the life of its landfill by decreasing the amount that's thrown away in the first place. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler reports.
It's a fall morning in Sheridan. Orange and yellow leaves are blowing around the streets. The sun is shining, and there's a little chill in the air. And I'm out collecting garbage. Solid waste operator Tony Trangmo is taking me in his truck as he goes through his normal Friday collection route. He's driving through skinny alleys, and his truck is picking up giant trash cans with a mechanical arm and dumping the contents into the truck to be smashed and hauled away to the landfill. This is like any other trash collection route in Sheridan, but that's changing soon. Starting on November 1st, Sheridan will begin a pilot pay-as-you-throw program to see if it can improve its waste diversion. This neighborhood will be a part of that study.
Pay-as-you-throw is metered trash collection, and it just treats that utility like all the others. So the more trash you throw away, the more you pay. The less you throw away, the less you pay.
That's Sheridan City Councilman Jacob Martin. He proposed the idea to the city council. The goal of the study is to see if residents start recycling more and lower the amount they put in the garbage. Throwing away less means residents can save money on their solid waste bill. Martin says he's always been interested in sustainability and thought a pay-as-you-throw program would help Sheridan become more environmentally friendly.
It fit really well because we already had a lot of the pieces in place that makes the program effective. So one of those is curbside recycling. We already have that. We have a great team at the landfill. And the recycling center needs some capital improvements, but overall, it's really well ran.
Sheridan Utilities Director Dan Roberts says they designed the program to be structured by the size of trash can. For the pilot program, residents will have three options to choose from.
A 35-gallon container, a 65-gallon container, and then the 95-gallon container. And the 95, by comparison, is the standard cart, we call them. Cart size. And so people could have a choice to stay with the standard cart size, or they could reduce to one of those other two smaller ones.
Robert says the idea is that smaller cans will cost less and save residents money.
The pilot area includes 729 households in the southwest part of Sheridan that covers a range of demographics. A little more than 20% of homes are opting for the smallest containers. Another 23% are choosing the medium size. The rest, including the people who haven't responded, will get the standard 95-gallon container. Solid waste operator Trangmo says one issue he hopes the program resolves is people abusing the system and putting yard waste and other items into trash cans that don't belong in the landfill. He says the pilot program will benefit those who take advantage of green waste dumpsters and other solid waste and recycling programs. Sheridan resident Joe Mentock lives in the pilot study area. He says he's excited for the program to start and thinks it will help promote recycling in town.
Overall, yes, I'm for it. We're going to go to the mid-size, and that will be our responsibility.
But a point of concern is the program's cost. If pay-as-you-throw was approved, it would take years to fully roll out all over town. The city would have to buy new trash cans for residents. The recycling center would need improvements to handle the potential increase in recycling. The long-term goal of the program is to lower the amount of trash sent to the landfill. The city is projecting it would cost around $280,000 over 5 years annually to seriously increase Sheridan's waste diversion numbers overall. But that calculation accounts for instituting pay-as-you-throw and other improvements. Councilman Aaron Linden says he was skeptical of the program at first, primarily because of the cost. But then he realized expanding the landfill costs even more.
If we could extend the life of that for 10 years, I mean, that saves us more than what we're going to put into it in the first 5 years.
For the past several weeks, the city has been collecting baseline data to see what people are throwing away in the pilot area. Eventually, they'll use that data to see if there's been waste diversion. So far, they've learned that 7% of waste going to the landfill is recyclable, and they'd like to see that number go down. Linden says it's hard to gauge right now how and how much a pay-as-you-throw program would benefit the city, and that they'll have to wait and see how the data and projected costs would shake out. The program begins in November and will run for 6 months. Robert says his department will crunch those numbers and report back to the city council at the end of the pilot study. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler in Sheridan.
When StoryCorps came to Jackson, former Marine Corps Captain Bob Morris sat down with his friend Jonathan Schechter to talk about his opposition to the Vietnam War and how he tried to end it.
What's the most significant thing that's ever happened to you, Bob?
I suppose Vietnam. And I didn't even go there. Headquarters Marine Corps knew that I was opposed to the war and had reason to fear that if I were sent to Vietnam, I would change sides.
But then you moved to Wyoming. Why Wyoming?
Oh, Wyoming had two votes in the Senate, like any state, but the smallest population in the Union. So by moving to Wyoming, you maximize your weight in the U.S. Senate. And then I learned that there was a congressional candidate in my home district, and I went to work for him with no chance of getting him elected. I'd spend evenings at Calico Pizza Parlor, which is where ski bums would congregate, trying to persuade them to register to vote. And the ski bums would answer, "Voting? Why, that's one of the responsibilities we came here to avoid." And their other response was, "Bob, it doesn't matter whom we vote for or who gets elected, the war will keep going." But we did stop the war by voting, and the vote in the House was 201 to 201. To keep the war going, all Nixon needed was one more vote.
So the congressman you came here to help support was instrumental,
yes,
in defunding the war.
Yes. He cast the deciding vote. So I came to the right state.
That's Bob Morris and Jonathan Schechter at StoryCorps in Jackson last summer. This piece was produced by Alex Schaefer.
Thanks for listening to our award-winning news program, Open Spaces. Past shows and stories from this week's program are available on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Thanks to the many of you who contribute to this station in support of our outstanding Wyoming news coverage. You too can help with a pledge at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.